Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Coming up this hour, as Americans continue to reckon with systemic racial inequities laid bare by the killing of George Floyd and other African Americans, we're going to talk about reparations for slavery and what it would mean to implement a compensation system here in California, as some lawmakers, activists, and scholars have proposed. But first, an update on the COVID situation. Governor Gavin Newsom announced today that he's rolling back reopening for the entire state of California. Let's hear what the governor had to say today.
We are now effective today, requiring all counties to close their indoor activities, their indoor operations in the following sectors: restaurants, wineries, tasting rooms, movie theaters, family entertainment centers, zoos and museums, card rooms, and the shuttering of all bars. This is in every county in the state of California.
So let's talk about how Bay Area cities are adjusting their reopening plans in light of what we just heard from the governor with his announcement, and how the Bay Area is dealing with a spike in hospitalizations. We'll also get the latest on coronavirus treatment and prevention. So joining us to discuss this is Aaron Alday, health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome back to City Visions, Aaron.
Thanks for having me again.
And we're also joined, as usual, by Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist at UCSF Medical School. Welcome back to City Visions, Peter.
Always a pleasure, Ethan.
Aaron, let's start with you. I want to take stock of where we are. Can you talk about Governor Newsom's announcement today and how it affects the Bay Area? I mean, for example, today Santa Clara County allowed hair salons, nail salons, spas, gyms to reopen. So are all those plans now overridden?
Yeah, pretty much the answer is yes, they are. Santa Clara was a bit of a mystery actually at first, at the start of the day, because they just sort of got on the state watch list to close down some of these places. So it was a little unclear if this would affect them or not, but they did confirm that all of these places that were allowed to just reopen today, including, as you said, gyms and nail salons and whatnot, will have to shut down again on Wednesday. So I would imagine they're probably, a lot of these places not going to bother, or maybe they'll just try to line up customers today and tomorrow. Going back to kind of the state thing, this is a pretty dramatic move on the governor's part. I think it's a real sign that he's not liking the way numbers are going. He's been very resistant to shutting things down on a statewide basis again. So this was a pretty big gesture on his part to close down. I mean, for starters, close down bars. Bars are just entirely closed down all over the state. They can't do indoor activity. They can't do outdoor. Can't do outdoor nothing. And then a lot of indoor operations, again, are closed everywhere in the state, regardless of if they're on this watch list or not. And then some further restrictions in counties that are on this watch list, which applies to, I believe, about 29 counties. The Bay Area, it's sort of hit and miss because a lot of places in the Bay Area had either already moved slowly and hadn't yet opened up some of those places, or they had already kind of rolled things back. Like San Francisco, for example, had decided to delay, you know, resuming indoor restaurants. A lot of places hadn't opened up bars yet or had decided to close them down, you know, a few days or even a week or more ago. This isn't going to be necessarily a huge effect in the Bay Area, though there will certainly be some businesses that this is going to be a big deal for, you know, like we talked about, the hair salons and nail salons, a lot of those places. And, you know, I'm sure that they're really frustrated. It's got to be really hard for these places just economically to have thought they could pick up business again and now being back where they were in March.
Well, clearly it's not a sign that we're going in the right direction if we have to roll this back statewide. So, Aaron, can you give us a little bit of a picture of where we are in terms of the latest on this, with state health officials reporting more than 13,000 new cases? So what's the picture exactly now in the Bay Area with respect both to new hospitalizations?
You're right that we're just not seeing things going the direction we want them to go. Every time we think maybe we've had a day or two of little bit lower numbers, they seem to bounce right back the next day. You know, we just did some number crunching in-house, and I think according to us, we've been on average about 8,000 cases a day in California for the past week or two, whereas we were half that about in June. So, you know, that's a really dramatic increase, and we're seeing that sustained over time. It just keeps growing and growing. The Bay Area's been a little bit better, but not a lot. You know, definitely we're seeing record-breaking daily cases in just about every county, you know, each week. You know, there's some new spike. And the hospital numbers are picking up both in the Bay Area and California. In both places, they're higher than they've ever been. So that's just, you know, even if we're starting to see little tiny hints that maybe we're getting some kind of semblance of control back, that things are slowing down, you know, I think some of the concern is that this could be temporary. All of these numbers we're seeing, there always is this lag time because it's built into this disease. It has a long incubation period. It takes a while for symptoms to come up. It takes a while for people to choose to get tested and then to get test results. So all of these numbers reflect something that's happening in the community a week or two ago. And so it's concerning to folks when we see these cases continue to climb that, you know, anything that we enact right now, we won't even see if that helps us for another couple of weeks.
And Peter, let me go to you. How do you explain the fact that, you know, if we were a school in California, we would not be getting very good grades right now on coronavirus? What is underlying all of this?
So I think, you know, picking up on what Aaron just said last, I think it's really interesting that because of the long incubation period and because people don't transmit COVID when they're necessarily symptomatic, there isn't necessarily an immediate benefit of the reaction of the actions that people take on the outside. And when I speak to my psychology colleagues, they all say, well, you know, like you might say, well, I talked to my neighbor last week and I wasn't wearing a mask and look, he didn't get COVID. And I think we're also victims of our own success because unlike, you know, family and friends in New York, when they knew somebody, everybody knew somebody who had COVID, you know, in California, we didn't have quite that surge. So I think that that negative example isn't there. Like, you know, when we explain HIV risk behaviors in the current generation compared to the old days, it's very similar. So again, multiple reasons for the surge, and people are just tired, you know, lockdown fatigue.
Well, and Peter, we have noticed that one troubling trend that may explain some of the numbers, which is the aggressive spread of coronavirus in our state's prison population. San Francisco hospitals are among those treating the sick. And on Friday, state officials announced that up to 8,000 inmates may be released early to stem this outbreak. Do you think that would be enough to try to address what's happening in our prison population?
Definitely not. I think the overall argument for decarceration in general or decompression, first of all, should be not conflated with what's going on in San Quentin, which frankly is an absolute emergency, public health emergency, and should be targeted separately. So again, the devil is in the details. But even if you take that 8,000 number, you'd have to release 20,000 inmates to reach 100% capacity because we're overcrowded right now. And for San Quentin, as a public health emergency, just think about what you think about a recommendation for a restaurant. You'd want them to be 30 to 50% decompressed for safe distancing, and that's not happening.
And Peter, I wanted to ask you about another perennial issue that's on all of our minds, which is masks. And today, Contra Costa County tightened its mask requirements following the spike in cases. So now you need to, in Contra Costa, you need to wear masks in all outdoor dining areas, except when you're eating, of course. And you also need to wear masks with extended family social bubbles. So can you just remind us, listeners, what kind of mask would you say is best?
So I would say any mask is best. And I think about a mask as a pair of jeans so that the comfort and the fit is more important than the type of mask, with one exception I'll get to. And I think people who have negative mask experiences probably haven't tried another one. For example, I got a mask from a really great colleague and it was homemade, but it was really suffocating. And I only knew that because I, you know, use a bunch of different kinds of masks just for my day-to-day work. So I would say to people that really try another one. The one mask that's kind of a no-no, which a lot of people have been wearing because it's not really clear in the messaging that they're not good, is the mask with valves. And that's because people use it for DIY projects or construction, and it filters air that comes in, but it doesn't, it's a one-way valve. So when you blow stuff out, you can blow all the coronaviruses to everyone. And I think people don't necessarily know that. So I would say for sure not to wear that. But if you need to wear it for allergies or other reasons, to put a cloth or a face covering in front of it to protect others.
All right, Peter, thank you for that helpful advice on the masks. Aaron, I want to go back to something that you mentioned. You said that the statewide order is not really likely to affect the Bay Area so much because the counties here haven't really been opening at the same level as perhaps the other counties, for example, Southern California. And it seems like a lot of the new cases are coming from Southern California, from the LA, San Diego, the border region. Do you have any sense as to why it is that the Bay Area seems to be doing a bit better than other parts of the state?
That's a really good question. There certainly is a sense that it's possible that this is all, or a lot of this can be tied to the Bay Area's, getting on top of this much, even just a few days earlier than Southern California. So going all the way back into March, the fact that we were the first to shut down, and it was only by a few days, but at that time, LA County in particular was already further along its curve, its path. In terms of case counts and community transmission is sort of the thinking. And so the Bay Area just kind of got a little bit better control of this right out of the gate and a little bit earlier. And there are definitely some public health folks who think that that's made a big difference, that we just sort of got on top and really sort of forced that control early on. And also by doing a slower reopening has sort of held on to that degree of control. And so even though we are seeing our cases climb and we're seeing our hospital numbers climb, it's at a little bit more of a sustained kind of increase. So it's sort of within our grasp. And most of the folks that I talk to think that, you know, the Bay Area is going to be all right, that we're going to be able to take action, that we've shown in the past that we're willing to do what we need to do, and that we're not so far gone that we can't sort of wrestle this thing back. And so even though things don't look good now, it's more of sort of like, this is frustrating because we did all this work, we sheltered in place, like everybody's been responsible, but we're still back in this place. And these poor businesses that had hoped to reopen or even had a taste of reopening or having to shut down again, all of that is just incredibly unfortunate and really disappointing, but we're going to be okay. Our hospitals are going to be okay. In Southern California, you know, again, we don't know exactly why. Some of it potentially relates to the delay in reopening. The delay in shutting down. And a lot of it is probably there was just, for whatever reason, more political pressure down there to reopen faster. So those counties, you know, Los Angeles in particular, moved to reopen at a pretty quick pace, considering, you know, the nature of their outbreak and how many cases they had. And that probably, you know, didn't help matters, that they just had more people out there circulating at an earlier time. They're also closer to, you know, Imperial County has been a really big problem that's down there at the southern border for a long time. And just being closer, you know, just being down in Southern California, being closer to LA, closer to Orange County and San Diego, some of the effects in that specific county have really leaked into their neighbors down there.
And Aaron, I have to ask you on the subject of sort of geographical differences in the outbreak, the sort of the big question here, I think, looming for many Americans, which is that why do we see so many great success stories around the world, but the U.S. is now among this global hotspots? I mean, especially when you look at, you know, places like Taiwan, they've had 7 deaths, or, you know, Arizona, where I lost a dear friend from COVID just a couple of weeks ago, has had more deaths than the European Union or more cases than the European Union entirely. So what does your reporting indicate on that?
Well, I'm sorry to hear about your friend. That's really tough. And, you know, I mean, the United States is frankly more than a hotspot. I mean, we make up a full 25% of the global cases. That's, you know, we're owning this thing as far as just the number of cases and even the number of deaths. You know, there's a lot that goes into that. There isn't one answer as to why we've done so poorly with it. You know, some of it is federal leadership and a lack thereof. And, you know, that's coming from a lot of different sources. People say that some of that is just sort of who we are as a country. We don't like being told what to do. We don't like, you know, a government kind of putting us in our place. And even in California, where we shut down early, you know, and more so than a lot of states, what we did here was nothing what they did in China, where they were like bringing in the army and you know, setting up a quarantine around, you know, entire regions. You know, we let people go out and circulate, and folks I talked to, you know, this virus was largely sustained through the shelter in place order by our essential workers, these poor folks who had to keep going out to work, which is why we're seeing these large rates in Latinx and Black communities. Those were the folks who were still still working in grocery stores and drugstores, you know, doing restaurant takeout, like all the stuff that we were using during shelter in place. They were the ones who were getting sick in that time period and kind of kept this level of virus circulating in our community, even in places like the Bay Area, where we did about the best job that anybody did in the United States. So just culturally, we weren't kind of prepared to do that. We also have this systemic, you know, disparity issues that compound this, that a lot of other countries don't have to the same degree. So there's just, I mean, there's frankly, there are just a lot of reasons why we have been not as good as other countries at doing this. But the truth is, I mean, it's just in the numbers. We really, you know, as you know, someone told me last week, we just suck at pandemic.
Well, I appreciate you taking a stab at it. I know it was a very big question to answer, but I think you gave us some helpful insights there. Peter, we just have another couple minutes left. I wanted to ask you about any new words since we had you on the show last week on treatments or a vaccine.
Yes, so the vaccine front in terms of studies continues to proceed. I think since the last time we spoke, we're still generally optimistic, although some people in the middle feel like we still wouldn't be ready by spring, and certainly not by a full rollout. But on the treatment front, we have still remdesivir. You know, we are going to run out pretty soon if our rates continue to go up, certainly with the, you know, transfers in from San Quentin and the regular community surge, because we only have a limited supply that's been allocated from the federal government by state, and that isn't keeping up with real-time needs. Convalescent plasma seems to be doing okay, and we've been using more steroids in general. So I think we've been better at taking care of patients who have COVID. So I feel that, you know, the deaths will probably reflect that, not being as high as early in the pandemic.
And on the related subject of testing, what do you say to people who are starting to lose confidence in how accurate these tests are? Is that really an issue that we should be concerned about?
In general, the virus test is pretty good as it comes. I think when people say it's inaccurate, it's like you might be negative and then you might be positive later on. And that's only because it's a snapshot and you may still be incubating virus and then positive later on. There are very, very few false positives because it's basically looking for that genetic signature that's only right there in SARS-CoV-2 that causes COVID-19. There's the antigen test that's a little bit worse performing, and that's what they use in the White House. But for the most part, the rest of the country is using, for the virus test, standardized sort of like PCR, which is pretty good as it comes.
And Peter, are we getting any closer to a home test that we could take pretty conveniently?
No, I mean, I mean there are different pockets of study, that cell swab, which I really love. I also love the idea of saliva testing, but it hasn't really taken on, and I'm not sure why. The Major League Baseball is using saliva tests for their 14,000 tests a week, which is amazing. I wish we can use more of it because it's so much more humane than having somebody do a brain biopsy on you.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you again for joining us. Aaron Alday, health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, and Peter Chin Hong, infectious diseases specialist at UCSF. Thank you both so much for joining us again.
Thanks everyone.
All right, and coming up next, is it finally time to start making amends for slavery? We'll speak to a panel of Bay Area thinkers and racial equity advocates about what reparations could look like now in California. Welcome back to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. The deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and other Black Americans at the hands of law enforcement have sparked large-scale protests in the Bay Area and beyond. And while much of the national conversation in the aftermath of these demonstrations has focused on police violence and reform, activists and scholars are asking if the time has finally come for reparations for slavery. For the remainder of this hour, we'll explore the history of the reparations movement in the United States and discuss what can be done here in California and nationally to bridge the racial wealth divide. Joining us are Angela Glover Blackwell, the founder in residence of PolicyLink, a national organization working to advance racial and economic equity. Angela is also the co-author of the June 26th New York Times opinion piece, Banks Should Face History and Pay Reparations. Welcome, Angela.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And we're also joined by Dr. Charles Henry, a professor emeritus of African American Studies at UC Berkeley, and the author of numerous books and articles, including Long Overdue, The Politics of Racial Reparations. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
And finally, we're joined by Stephanie Jones Rogers, an associate professor in the UC Berkeley Department of History and author of They Were Her Property, White Women as Slave Owners in the American South. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you so much for having me, Ethan.
And we also want to hear from you. So please give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255 to join this conversation and ask questions of our guest today. You can also send an email to cityvisions@kalw.org or find us on Twitter. We're at cityvisionskalw. Well, Angela Glover Blackwell, let me start with you. Can you tell us, when we say reparations, what are we talking about?
Well, I think that we're talking about it now, not just because of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, but also COVID has a lot to do with it. I think that the American people have seen, particularly white people, what the impact of extraordinary racial oppression over many generations, hundreds of years now, has done in terms of making Black people just so vulnerable. And so when I think about reparations, I think about acknowledging, apologizing, and repairing the harm that has been done by the mistreatment of Black people in America. Certainly stealing people from Africa, enslaving people for hundreds of years, and then not making amends when slavery ended. So when we talk about reparations, it is definitely for slavery, but it's also for Jim Crow. Is for Reconstruction, is for what didn't happen after the Civil Rights Movement. There's a long history of state-sponsored oppression of Black people in this country that needs to be acknowledged, apologized for, repaired, and people need to be compensated so that we can finally get on even footing and start moving forward in a way that is fair and just.
And so when we talk about reparations, we're not just talking about an economic payment in your mind. This is about more than that. It's about an acknowledgement and an apology. I mean, how would you sort of break out the different, you know, reasons and benefits for reparations in this country?
I think the acknowledgement is so important because we're such an ahistorical country. Not only do people actually not know the facts about slavery and all of that, but many people who do know about it have whitewashed what it really is. We need to have an acknowledgement so that this country can face and own that this was a nation founded on genocide, stolen land, and human bondage. Then the immorality of that requires an apology. I think it would just help so many people in this country to have this nation apologize for its wrongdoing. Moving forward, we certainly need to be thinking about monetary compensation because that is a concept that people understand. It has happened in other settings worldwide. It's happened here in terms of Japanese internment. We need to do that. And we need to do other things because we've got to really make up for all the harm that's been done. So we need a robust policy agenda that is anti-racist and centers Blackness. And there are a lot of people who have been thinking about what that agenda needs to look for. And I'm sure we'll talk about this later. I think that reparations and repair are not limited to government, though certainly government has the overwhelming responsibility to do something about what it has done.
And Stephanie Jones Rogers, as Angela just mentioned, there is a precedent for reparations in this country. And I think a lot of Americans don't necessarily know that. Can you tell us about the history of reparations in the United States and other nations as well to give us some context?
Absolutely. So I think it's first important for us to recognize that the federal government had no problem compensating slave owners for emancipation. So in many respects, slave owners were the primary recipients of reparations for slavery in 1862. In addition to that, Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, actually called for compensating all slave owners in states that voluntarily agreed to emancipate African Americans. The Confederates refused, of course, but nevertheless, there were provisions built into emancipation to compensate, to offer reparations to slave owners rather than enslaved people. But the calls, the demands of African Americans for reparations are certainly not new. Formerly enslaved people asked for them both after the American Revolution and after the Civil War. For example, there was a formerly enslaved woman named Callie House who led a movement for reparations in the 1890s under the auspices of an organization called the National Ex-Slave Mutual Relief Bounty and Pension Association. She was eventually arrested because the government claimed that she was participating in fraudulent activities. But nevertheless, as my colleague Angela has already said, the U.S. government has, in fact, provided and paid reparations to other Americans for the injustices that had been perpetrated against them via government policy and actions. Ronald Reagan in 1988 passed the Civil Liberties Act, which not only issued a formal apology, but also granted $1.6 billion in economic reparations to Japanese Americans who were interned in camps throughout the United States during World War II. The federal government has also compensated indigenous people for treaty violations, discrimination, and racial violence. And there are even two occasions in which the federal government, or in one case, the state government, another, the federal government, actually compensated African Americans for injustices perpetrated against them. The first was federal reparations to male victims of what was called the Tuskegee Syphilis Study, which was a public health service study in which individuals were not given treatment, even though a treatment was available. So the federal government has offered reparations to both the victims of that study as well as their descendants in the form of money and medical treatment. And Florida recently decided to compensate Black residents of a little town called Rosewood in Florida, which was destroyed by white mobs. And in terms of other countries, Germany paid Jewish people the equivalent of $14.8 billion for atrocities they committed during the Holocaust. The British paid the Mau Mau people of Kenya $31 million for atrocities they committed against them. Iraq paid Kuwaitis for its invasion of the country and for injustices committed during the Gulf War. Colombia paid victims of state violence. And South Africa, probably the most important example of this, paid reparations to victims of apartheid. So there is this long history, both in the country, but also abroad, of reparations being paid in circumstances similar to what we're talking about here.
So Stephanie, that's a really helpful overview of the context of history and what's been going on in other nations. Some of the examples that you mentioned, though, involve people who are still alive, who are the victims who were, you know, directly alive from what the injustice was. And I want to read a quote from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who came out publicly opposing reparations. And he said, "I don't think reparations for something that happened 150 years ago, for whom none of us currently living are responsible, is a good idea." So what is your response to that comment? I'm sure you hear that kind of a criticism of this idea a lot.
Absolutely. So first, I don't think that Mitch McConnell has been paying any attention to past or contemporary calls for reparations. He clearly is focused on a monetary reparation program in mind. But in reality, as Angela has already explained, African-American calls for reparations are multidimensional. Activists have called for economic reparations, but they've also proposed other forms of reparations, too. For example, Indiana law professor Carlton Waterhouse has proposed reparations in the forms of monuments, museums, memorials, and even educational programs, and they go beyond that. And in addition to that, reparations, at least more contemporary calls for reparations, aren't specific to slavery. They include reparations for injustices and inequities of the post-slavery era, of which there are many. We know about Jim Crow, which was a federal and state-sanctioned system of racial oppression, the vestiges of which we continue to grapple with today. We don't typically think of lynching as forms of economic violence and expropriation, but these atrocities were often economic in their basis. Other forms of injustice that African Americans are seeking reparations for are federal, state, and community sanctioned housing segregation policies and processes, such as redlining and racial covenants. And one of the biggest, which we often don't talk about, is the unlawful exclusion of many African American veterans from the benefits of the GI Bill. So when we talk about reparations, we're not simply talking about, reparations for a system long gone. We're also talking about contemporary systems of racial oppression for which many African Americans survive today. There are survivors of those systems today, and their descendants are surviving today.
All right. Well, if you're just joining us, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco. We're talking about reparations for slavery in the United States. We want to hear from you. What do reparations mean to you? You can join the conversation at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can send us an email to cityvisions@kalw.org or find us on Twitter at City Visions KALW. Well, Dr. Charles Henry, a lot of what we've been talking about with reparations is about the sort of ongoing economic harm that's been done to African Americans and has continued to be perpetrated on African Americans in this country. And a lot of this is often boiled down to this idea of the racial wealth gap. Can you describe what that is exactly and how large it is?
Well, the figures that we've seen most recently are that Black Americans have about 10% of the wealth of white Americans, and that even poor whites have some wealth, whereas Blacks have none. And for most Americans, their wealth is in the form of home ownership. Roughly 40-some percent of African Americans own their own home, 70-some percent of whites own their own home, and we can directly trace that back to the inability of Blacks to get government loans, guaranteed mortgage in this century. But, you know, we can go back to the period right after the Civil War and the Homestead Act. And the Homestead Act opened up the West. It opened up the West for whites to essentially gain free land in the West, but that was not open to Blacks. And roughly 20% of white Americans today can trace their investment in land back to the Homestead Act. So we can look at, you know, land ownership as wealth, but certainly you could look at things like minimum wage and salaries, the New Deal, for example, and Social Security passed by Franklin Roosevelt's administration. The two largest categories of Black employment, domestic workers and agricultural workers, were not included in the New Deal in Social Security. And the reason for that was the South objected to that because this was their labor force in agriculture, and domestics were wanted and needed, and they didn't want to pay the minimum wage. So when you look at both income and when you look at property ownership, you begin to see this gap in wealth. But there are lots of other things we could talk about in terms of redlining, access to small business loans, segregated schools, et cetera, that, you know, accumulate and contribute to that gap.
Well, and Angela Glover Blackwell, to put some of what Dr. Charles Henry just put into more of a sort of a personal context or a human context, can you paint a picture of what the financial and social consequences of this racial wealth gap is for Black and for Brown Americans as well?
The absence of wealth for Black and Brown communities is just devastating in terms of families trying to make it today. When you think about wanting to send a child to college, when there's a health emergency, when there's a desire to start a small business, when you have to just make it when you lose your job for a little while, all of these things are things that people rely on their wealth to see them through. The systematic stealing of wealth and stopping opportunities to be able to build it have placed Black people and Brown people in this country at an extreme disadvantage. It started with slavery. People had their labor stolen from them, and they had no ability to be able to build up savings from hard labor. There's an atrocity right there. People, as they began to come out of slavery, were stopped from their attempts to be able to own land and farms and to start to move forward. One of the ways that this country actually has built the middle class is through education and through business. And education was not available to people who don't have the wealth to get it. And when people were able to get an education who were Black, they were stopped because of discrimination from being able to get jobs in which they could get a real toehold in terms of beginning to build a nest egg, to be able to build wealth. And people who were starting businesses never were able to build the businesses that they really could have with their ingenuity and their creativity and their access to their own labor, which was some of the most skilled labor in the land, because they couldn't get bank loans. They couldn't build those businesses and go forward. And when they did do it, like on Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which we now all know more about than we ever did before recent events, that was just destroyed violently and taken away. And so the process of stealing wealth and stripping wealth has gotten to the point where Black people now are still struggling in ways that they should not. And I was interested in the quote that you just gave from Senator Mitch McConnell talking about not being responsible for paying people for something that happened a long time ago. People are certainly happy to reap the wealth that they are able to have now who are white because of what happened a long time ago, the land that they've been able to build on, the inheritance that they've been able to build on, the salaries that they've been able to make because they haven't been competing with other people, Black and otherwise, to be able to get jobs and move forward. I want to come back to the notion of why reparations. It is so important that this nation acknowledge how mean and immoral and destructive the behavior has been by organized government in this country, holding Black people back, not allowing them to be able to get what they needed to move forward. And when they have moved forward, finding ways to strip it away in Tulsa by going in and violently taking it, but then in ways that people were not able to build wealth. Well, think about our system of safety net that has it in the safety net programs that if you have a certain level of wealth, you no longer can have access to the things that allow you to be able to just live the simplest of life. And so we are at a crossroads. I'm thrilled to see that we are here, but I also know it's going to take a lot of education and a lot of soul searching for people to be able to step into this moment and provide reparations. But I think nothing short of that is going to move us to the next level.
Well, absolutely. I think you make a very powerful case for the history of this and the ever-present nature of this dynamic. And you know, when we think about economic wealth, a lot of it is how it compounds over time. And so, you know, these injuries that may have been 150 years ago, that wealth compounds unfairly for many white institutions and white Americans, and unfairly for people of color. So, Stephanie Jones Rogers, we just heard Angela reference the Tulsa, Oklahoma massacre there. And can you describe a bit about the historical context here for Tulsa and perhaps other examples of where efforts by African Americans to build wealth have been suppressed?
Yeah. So on May 30th, 1921, it was a young Black man named Dick Rolland. He was in the elevator with a young white woman, Sarah Page. And no one is quite sure exactly what happened, but the assumption was that he tried to assault her. As a consequence of these rumors, a white mob attempted to capture him, and members of the African-American community in the Greenwood District of Tulsa, Oklahoma, believed that he was going to be lynched. And so they defended themselves, they armed themselves, and they sought to protect him from white mobs and from white vigilante justice. They were outnumbered, unfortunately. And so as a consequence of this kind of battle, this armed battle, they fled to Greenwood District, and over the course of 24 hours, white rioters looted and burned the Greenwood District, destroyed thousands of homes, churches, schools, businesses, even a hospital and a library. And over the course of that time, 800 people were injured and 300 people were dead, most of them African American. This area, Greenwood District, is called Black Wall Street because it was one of the most prosperous Black communities in the country, if not the most prosperous community in the country. And I mentioned earlier the ways in which racial violence and economic expropriation and exploitation are connected. This is a case in point. this white mob, these white mobs destroyed this town, not simply because of Dick Rowland and the accusations against him, but because this community was a beacon. This community was it signified all that African Americans could accomplish if left to their own devices, if white folks got out of their way, and that had to be destroyed. And so that was at the core of it. That was what the Tulsa riots were all about. And unfortunately, those members of the Tulsa those individuals, African Americans, who survived the Tulsa riots, have attempted to receive reparations. They have called for reparations, and judges have actually denied them their ability to do so because of statutes of limitations, unfortunately. So there are, again, these cases in point where reparations could be given, but the justice system is unjust when it comes to African Americans. Some other really important examples of how African Americans have attempted to build wealth but have been suppressed have already been mentioned by Professor Henry, for example, the exclusion of domestic and agricultural laborers from both unemployment and Social Security. The Social Security program, even though their taxes helped to sustain those programs. So they paid taxes and those taxes went into those programs, but they could not reap the benefits of those programs. The GI Bill is another major one, particularly for the 20th century. And this goes back to the comment of Mitch McConnell about, you know, these long past institutions and systems having nothing to do with the present. Well, this is in 1944. The GI Bill is passed. 1.4 million Black men serve in the armed forces during World War II. 6,200 Black women served in the Women's Auxiliary Army Corps, and they were largely denied the ability to reap the benefits of tuition-free college. So there were educational benefits, tuition-free college and vocational school, and a cost of living stipend, economic unemployment benefits for up to 1 year, as well as job counseling, federally guaranteed loans for veterans who wanted to purchase homes or start businesses or begin farms, and medical care. And they are largely excluded from these benefits because 77% of African Americans lived in the South during World War II era. Jim Crow laws reigned in that area. And the GI Bill was designed to accommodate the exclusionary practices of the South. So many African Americans were subjected to discrimination because program officials were often white Southerners, and they often would give the best work, the best opportunities, the best of everything of the GI Bill to other white vets, so largely excluding African Americans. So this means that they were denied loans for housing and business. They were excluded from many job training programs. And of course, as you mentioned, all of these exclusions, all of these denials compound to ensure that a certain amount of wealth is not only they're unable to accumulate that wealth, but they're also unable to pass that wealth on to their children. So those are some really important examples of how African Americans have tried to accumulate wealth and have been denied. And that's not even to mention all of the African Americans who owned farms, owned land, owned homes, built communities, and were banished from those communities. And those communities were then taken by white Southerners. And they never received recompense for that kind of violation.
All right. Well, let's bring in some listeners to this conversation. I think it's been really a rich discussion so far, but I want to hear from callers. So we have Howard calling in from San Jose. Howard, welcome to City Visions.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for having me on. You asked about what reparations mean to people listening to the show, and I wanted to put 2 points of what reparations mean to me. First is that reparations must involve educating people that everybody who lives in this country is responsible for making things the way they are now. I'm not white. I'm not Black. My parents are immigrants, and they constantly told me growing up to stay away from Black people, and I can't let them get away from that. And second of all, I don't think you can have reparations unless you abolish systems like the prison system and the police forces, because any time you can allow a government to have a monopoly over violence, it will always, always find a way to use it against minorities and people who don't have power in that government. That's all I wanted to say.
Howard, no, thank you for those points that you raised. And let me direct those to Angela Glover-Blackwell. I think Howard raises some interesting sort of systemic issues that might need to be addressed when it comes to reparations. But you know, first of all, just in responding to Howard, could you also just describe a bit about how you would envision reparations working? I mean, from individual versus a collective reparations, how would you see it sort of happening in practice?
Thank you. I want to comment on Howard's observation that a lot of people are complicit in the oppression of Black people in this country. That is certainly right. And it will not be difficult for people who want to be part of making it right to use their vote and to support those people who are out there calling for change. I also want to embrace what he said about the really revolutionary, radical, systemic transformation that has to happen to make this right. Those issues about the prison system, police, and all these others, these have to be addressed. And many of these systems were actually developed to oppress Black people. A big source of policing in America had to do with slavery, catching runaway slaves, and other things related to it. He's so right there. And I think we have to think both individually. I don't ever want to shy away from the conversation about individual compensation. I don't have a way to be able to do it, but I know there many smart people who could figure it out. That is not something that is daunting to the point of cannot pursue it. It needs to be pursued. But Stephanie was talking about the GI Bill. That is a perfect example of how this country, when it decides to step up and invest in wealth creation, it knows how to do it. It is no stretch to say that the GI Bill made the white middle class. Without the GI Bill and the buying of homes in the suburbs and education, when the GI Bill first started, there were only about 40 community colleges in the United States. Within a few years, there were over 300. The investment in that education and home ownership, where people through their jobs and through their property are able to build their wealth, is something that this country has done in the past. It could do it again with a different kind of focus. I also think that it's going to be important to be able to not make this either or. We're not going to have either a robust policy agenda or compensation. We can individually compensate people, and we can collectively make sure that we begin to develop an opportunity platform in this nation. And one of the things that is true is that if we solve these problems from the point of view of Black people, because of the history of Black people in this country, we create a platform and a framework that will begin to deal with inequality and oppression for many other groups. And so we need to go on and focus on it, not thinking that we're going to exclude others who also suffer from oppression, but that we are going to tear down the system of oppression so that no one will have to share that burden. And so we need a collective response that will become a national response in terms of what the overall impact will be. But we need that policy response to repair the damage and create a pathway forward. But we also need, through that apology and that compensation, to really acknowledge that this country has placed people at a disadvantage because of the color of their skin. And it was not a one-time thing. Stephanie began to point that out. It was slavery, but it was also Jim Crow, and it was Reconstruction, and it was continuing discrimination, and it was the failures of the Civil Rights Movement. And we talked about the destruction of Tulsa, but there were economic points of viability in Black communities all across the country that urban renewal, which was often called Black removal, actually destroyed. Right here in Oakland, California, there was a vibrant jazz district down on 7th Avenue that got destroyed. But I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, where the same story can be told. We can fix this, but it is going to take dedication, it's going to take money, and it's going to take policy leaders who actually step up legislatively to do the right thing.
All right. Well, I want to thank Howard for that call and Angela for your response to him. For those tuning in, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. And we're talking about reparations for slavery. We're joined by Angela Glover-Blackwell, the founder and residence of Policy Link, and also the host of the podcast Radical Imagination. And we're also joined by Dr. Charles Henry, professor emeritus of African-American studies at UC Berkeley, and by Stephanie Jones Rogers, associate professor at the UC Berkeley Department of History. We do want to hear from you what reparations might mean to you, how we as a society should recognize and come to terms with the racial injustice in both our past and present. You can call to join the conversation 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or send an email to cityvisions@kalw.org, or on Twitter, we're @cityvisionsk. KALW. Well, Dr. Charles Henry, I want to go to you for some of the details about how reparations would work in practice. Who would be eligible for reparations? How much money would be allocated? How would they be financed? Can you fill in some of the details here for us?
A segue into your question. The city of Chicago paid reparations for police torture in 2015 to a number of Black citizens who had brought lawsuits against the Chicago police. One precinct in particular was known for torturing people who had been brought to that station. And a multiracial coalition put pressure on the city council, and the city council eventually agreed to pay and issued a report, but eventually agreed to pay to those individuals who had been tortured $5 billion. They also agreed to include in the school curricula in Chicago information about the police and police brutality in Chicago. They granted free tuition to the survivors of torture, to their children, and to their grandchildren in the Chicago Community College school system. And they put up a memorial for the victims of torture. We've already discussed sort of Rosewood and Tulsa, which involved the taking of Black land. And I want to point out also what's happened in North Carolina in 2014, in which the state established a fund to give recompense to 7,000 women who were eligible, who had been forcefully sterilized in the state of North Carolina between 1929 and 1976. And I mentioned these various things, from forced sterilization to torture to the taking of land, to say there's no one shoe that fits all. And the legislation, both at the national level and at the state level, H.R. 40 at the national level, and the current bill in the California Assembly, 3121, call for a commission to study and develop reparations proposals. And you know, I think it's kind of putting the cart before the horse to sort of say, you know, well, how much should so-and-so get? We need to look at this issue. We need to look at the types of compensation that would do the best good and make the most difference in terms of giving Blacks either access to medical care, giving them a base to start a business, getting them a loan to buy a home. So, you know, it's kind of ironic that since this bill was modeled after the 1988 Civil Liberties Act that was mentioned earlier, and it was put in by John Conyers in 1989, and we weren't able to get hearings on the bill until last summer, when Sheila Lee Jackson's subcommittee in the House had hearings on the bill. And since then, Cory Booker has introduced similar legislation in the Senate. And both of those bills call for the study of the issue. Certainly, you would think an apology would be a part of this. And it's kind of ironic to me that I think it was back in the 80s, Congressman Tony Hall from Dayton introduced a bill that didn't have any dollars attached, just called for an apology. And he said he got more hate mail around that bill than any other bill, a bill of apology. The other sort of ironic thing is both Bill Clinton and George W. Bush went to Gorée Island off the coast of Senegal and apologized. In essence, politicians don't like to use the word apology, so they use severe regret, but apologized to Africans for the slave trade. But neither could come to Charleston or New Orleans or New York and apologize for African-American slavery. So I think we've got to start with kind of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission and then begin to work out the kinds of proposals that make sense in the 21st century.
Well, thank you for that that overview. And I think that explains, you know, hopefully for listeners, what the process might look like. We've got a couple callers I'd love to be able to get to. Let's start with Albert in San Francisco. Albert, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, how are you? My father, I'm 100% Italian American. Both my parents were born in Harlem in New York City. They lived in a predominantly African-American neighborhood in New York City. And I know that before my father had passed away, that this is when the conversation began about, providing something for African-Americans. And I believe that that is what should happen. But I don't believe it should happen just by giving out money or checks. I think that's too easy for America to do and for the government to do. I really think it should be in the form of opportunity and education and providing resources and services that white Americans have been provided. The other thing I wanted to say is one of the things my father said, because he had fought in World War II at the end in Okinawa, Japan, and he had said that one of the reasons why the GI Bill came to fruition was because you had all of these veterans coming back from whatever theaters they were fighting in.
And Albert, and just sorry to cut you off, but we're just running out of time. So can you just get to your question quickly?
They didn't understand why they were coming back. So one of the reasons why they started the GI Bill of Rights was to prevent an uprising. Because if you have veterans coming back from fighting a war that they didn't understand or you got to give them something, or else they're going to go against the government. Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Albert. So, Angela, just real quick, I wanted to go to you on Albert's point. What he seemed to be describing is almost like a affirmative action, basically. But, I mean, what do you make of a non-monetary compensation versus a monetary one?
I don't want to make it versus, and I said I didn't want to talk about either or. I think that we certainly need to compensate in ways that provide health care, access to education, support in starting small businesses, being able to have access to other things that help people build wealth, build their lives. But I did want to make sure that before we stop that I brought in this notion that was in the op-ed about banks, because it is not just government. In many ways, the financial institutions were underwriters of slavery, and in some cases, they really took ownership of Black bodies when loans were defaulted. They were the ones who, because of their discriminatory lending practices, segregated almost every major city in America. They are the same ones who, once redlining was outlawed, working with realtors, found ways to be able to trick and steal the money and repossess the homes of people who were Black. And not only that, financial institutions right up to the moment, in terms of excessive fees and charges, strip wealth, and the absence of being able to get bank loans keeps Black people from being able to expand their businesses right today. And the way that Black people often have to turn to usury to be able to buy things, that the consumer debt is much higher than it needs to be. And so banks too ought to look at what they have done and continue to do and step up in a big way and try to solve this problem. This is not going to be one size fits all. It's going to take a lot of strategies, and it's going to take the private sector as well as the public sector to be able to make this right.
And we're just about out of time. So Stephanie Jones-Rogers, I'm going to give you the last word. What would you like to see as some next steps here?
I would like to see H.R. 40 passed, as well as the all of the legislation at the state levels passed, so that we can begin to have the conversation where it matters.
All right. And since we have a few more seconds, Dr. Charles Henry, I'll give you the same question just in 20 seconds. What would you like to see as a next step?
Well, I think there's a better opportunity in California, unless, of course, the elections change things, in getting something through in California than in nationally. And so there is a study commission proposed for California, and I would hope Americans would, or Californians would, take a hard look at the history of slavery and Black oppression in California and support that legislation.
All right, well, we're going to have to leave it there. It's a very rich discussion, obviously a lot more we could talk about, but that's City Visions for this evening. I want to thank our guests, Angela Glover-Blackwell, founder and residence of PolicyLink. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Dr. Charles Henry, professor emeritus of African American Studies at UC Berkeley.
Thank you.
And finally, Stephanie Jones-Rogers, associate professor at UC Berkeley Department of History.
Thank you so much.
All right. And I also want to thank our previous guest, Aaron Alde, health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, and Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist at UCSF. Thanks so much for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer tonight was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang and Susie Britton. Join my co-host Joseph Pache next week as we discuss how Bay Area schools are planning to reopen in the fall. Good night, and stay safe and enjoy the rest of your week.